Good evening. Welcome to The Blues. I'm Lee Hay. Tonight, a special look at the Allman Brothers. I recently spoke with Alan Paul, who's written a new biography about the band entitled One Way Out. The Allman Brothers have announced that after 45 years together, 2014 will be their last year together. So tonight, my conversation with Alan Paul and the music of the Allman Brothers, including songs from their live album recorded at the Ludlow Garage in 1970, on The Blues.
Hi, I'm Alan Paul, the author of One Way Out, the inside history of the Allman Brothers Band. I'm a senior writer for Guitar World magazine, written for a lot of other publications, and I've been covering the Allman Brothers in various permutations and forms since about 1990. Founding members of the band were six guys: Dwayne Allman on guitar, Dickie Betts on guitar and vocals, although he didn't start singing until a couple of years into the band, Greg Allman on organ, a little bit of piano and vocals, Barry Oakley on the bass, and two drummers, Butch Trucks and the one-name wonder, J-Mo.
Could you talk about the instruments that they played back in the day?
Dwayne was already a fantastic guitar player, but did not play slide guitar. And when they were living in Los Angeles before the Allman Brothers Band, with a band called the Hourglass, Dwayne was very unhappy and struggling with being told what to play and forced to play various things, dress various ways by the record company. He went to see Taj Mahal, whose first record had just come out, at a club called the Magic Mushroom in Los Angeles. And Taj Mahal had a slide guitar player in his band named Jesse Ed Davis. And they played the old blues song, Statesboro Blues, a version that Taj had sort of redone in his own idea. And Dwayne was just blown away by it and went home with took a chlorcidian bottle of cold pills that Greg had given him when he had a bad cold, threw the pills out, took the label off, and just started messing around with it. And there's nothing worse sounding, really, than someone learning how to play slide guitar. So Johnny Sandlin, who was in the band, and Greg just said that they just couldn't stand the sound of Dwayne and that rackety slide. But just in a couple of days, all of a sudden, there it was. And but a year later, when the Allman Brothers Band formed, they made Statesboro Blues one of their signature songs. And it was written by Blind Willie McTell, but that version that they do so famously now was really taken from Taj Mahal's arrangement of it.
Woke up this morning.
Duane and Dickey Betts were both really renowned for their use of Gibson guitars, mostly Les Pauls and SGs. And both of them played Les Pauls and SGs. And there was an SG that each of them used. I think Dickey's, and he gave it to Duane, and who used it for slide guitar work. After Duane passed away, his guitars were in various places with various people. Greg had one of his Les Pauls. Twiggs Linden, the band's road manager, wanted to have it. He didn't want to have it for personal use. He wanted to secure it for Duane's daughter, Galadriel, who was only 2 or 3 years old at the time. I guess Twiggs was worried about what would happen with it in Greg's possession, who was going through his own drug issues at that time. So he eventually traded his beloved. Twiggs was a classic car fanatic. And Greg also is a great lover of old automobiles, and he traded a 1939, I believe, Ford Opera Coupe to Greg for the Les Paul, and he held on to it until Galadriel was of age. Twiggs passed away before that time. The guitar was maintained by his brothers with great care, who kept it and eventually met Galadriel's mother, Donna, at Duane's grave and presented it to her. In this great act of brotherhood, I guess you could say. And that guitar is now owned by Galadriel, but it's on display at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
There's an interview with Johnny Sandlin talking about Ray Charles' song Outskirts of Town that's on the Ludlow Garage 1970 album.
Right, that was a song, it's an arrangement of a Ray Charles song that Greg and Duane had turned into sort of a signature song. They recorded it in Muscle Shoals, Alabama with the Hourglass as a demo. They were very, very pleased with it. And they also did something called B.B. King Medley, and they were really happy with it. It showed the direction they wanted to go. They brought it back to their record label in Los Angeles, who just basically threw it in the trash, had no interest in putting out blues-based music. And that was when Duane got so frustrated, and he just left Los Angeles and ended up going back to the South, and eventually to Muscle Shoals, where he worked as a session guitarist. The song remained somewhat in their playlist. They didn't play it all that often. I'm not really sure why. They certainly played it beautifully. And I think one of the best versions, certainly the best recorded version of it that exists, is from Live at the Ludlow Garage CD.
outskirts of town. Well, I'm gonna move, baby. Yeah. Way back down on the outskirts of town. Yeah. Well, I don't need nobody, yeah. Always hanging around. Yeah, yeah. Let me tell you, baby, we're gonna move away from here. Well, I don't need no S-man. No, bye. Lord, I'm gonna buy you a prison there. Yeah. Oh, we're singing around. eternity, baby. As funny as it seems, we're gonna have a dozen children. They're all gonna look like me. Up in the moon. Way back down, way back down, on the outskirts of town. Oh, well, I don't need nobody, yeah. I'm always singing, yeah, no, no.
During your research for the book One Way Out, did you hear any stories about their stay here in Cincinnati while they played and rehearsed at the Ludlow Garage in 1970?
I don't have any details about that. It's one of these incidents in which everybody has a little bit different version of it, and there wasn't any one cohesive vision and nothing revelatory that happened quite to make it something that I went into in details. But the overriding impression that came from everyone is that they really loved Cincinnati. They felt it was a special place, and they especially loved the Ludlow Garage, which they felt was a very, very special place. There are just a handful of these clubs that really meant something special to the members of the band, and without a doubt, Ludlow Garage is one of them. You know, they also stayed with Don Law from the Boston Tea Party in Boston. And J-Mo actually was the one who had the most vivid memories of the time in Cincinnati. Everyone else, you know, it's just interesting because various things run together in their minds in various ways. And that was one of those things that was just hard to pin down exactly when and where that all was.
Well, I thought it was interesting, very interesting, your discussion about the jazz influence on the band and Whipping Post and Dreams, which is basically, quote, my favorite things, John Coltrane with Leary.
Right. That influence came mostly from J-Mo, the drummer. J-Mo really is and was a great lover of jazz. And as he said to me, I know for sure Duane had listened to Miles Davis before he met me. But by all accounts, J-Mo was the one who really got them listening to that. And they spent hours and hours listening, especially to Kind of Blue and to some of the other Coltrane stuff. They got very, very deeply into the song All Blues. The bass line for the song Dreams is taken right from that. J-Mo very proudly says that he played Jimmy Cobb's drum fills directly from All Blues on Dreams, and also the Coltrane My Favorite Things is one of their very favorite songs. They became very influenced by that musically, that sort of limited chord changes, modal playing.
Just one more morning, I had to wake up with the blues, pull myself out of bed, yeah, I put on my walking
And J-Mo also said that Whipping Post sounded just like Stormy Monday Blues.
Right. The original version that Greg brought in was a slow blues. And they were playing it, and they all recognized that they were brilliant lyrics, and there was a great song there, but it didn't seem quite right. And what J-Mo says is that Barry Oakley, the bass player, said, let's take a break on this and double back to it tomorrow. I have an idea. So he went home and messed around with it, and he came back the next day with that bass line. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Very famous bass line that totally changed the nature of the song, although it's credited only to Greg Allman. But that is how they did songwriting over the years in a lot of bands. You know, I don't think anyone understood in 1969 and 70 that who had the songwriting on a song would have such a economic impact down the road. They simply did songwriting by whoever brought the main song in, wrote the song, and the rest they considered arrangement. In that case, I think you could make a very strong argument that Barry Oakley wrote part of the song because the bass line and the time signature is so very, very distinctive.
heroin and drugs were an issue for the band during their career.
Drugs were present in the band from the very beginning. This is not certainly unusual for a group formed in 1969 in the middle of the drug culture. By the fall of 1971, the drug problem, specifically heroin, had gotten very, very bad for the band. Everyone in the group except for Butch Trux had a heroin problem to some extent or another, and it extended even to the road crew. Dwayne finally reached a point where he knew he needed help, and he decided everyone needed help, and he issued basically a presidential dictum that everyone had to get cleaned up. So he, Barry Oakley, and the crew members, Red Dog and Kim Payne, went up to Buffalo, New York to a rehab center, which was really a psychiatric hospital. Greg was supposed to go. I've seen a receipt for Greg's plane ticket, in fact, but he didn't show up. Dickie Betts and J-Mo both insisted they could take care of it themselves and did, in fact, for the time being at least, kick their habits. Dwayne and the other guys went up there. He emerged after really less than a week in the hospital. There's various versions, depending on who you talk to, of how clean Dwayne was. But most people feel that coming out of there, he really was clear-eyed. I think whatever help the rehab offered was maybe less significant than the fact that he had determined that it was a problem, that he had to change and was determined to do so. And just a couple of days later, he died, which I think adds even another layer of depth and tragedy to his passing.
What's your favorite song?
Boy, that's tough. I think that because of the band being so different and having these different sides, I'll have to pick a favorite Dickie song and a favorite Greg song. And my favorite Dickie song is probably Blue Sky, and my favorite Greg song is either Come and Go Blues or Dreams. Dreams, on the very first album, I think contains everything that makes the Allman Brothers great. Wonderful singing, lyrics, wonderful, wonderful slide and non-slide solo. Probably my very favorite, but if I only chose that, it would leave out this beautiful, upbeat, major key melodic side of the band that Dickie Betts brought. And Blue Sky is a song that just makes me happy and feel good anytime, no matter where I am or what I'm doing when I hear it. It makes me feel better. And what else could you really want from music than that?
Keep on flowing, and don't worry about where it's going. No, no.
mentioned that the Ludlow Garage 1970 album. It's a very solid set from April 1970, showing how much the band grew before recording at Fillmore East, and it's essential for hardcore fans. What do you think of the album?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the process of writing the book, I spent so much time listening to Allman Brothers music. And a couple of the archival releases that had come out over the years, I think I listened to a little bit more closely and with fresher ears. Ludlow was one of them, also the Live at the International Atlanta Pop Festival. And both of them are much stronger and more vibrant than I sort of gave them credit for at the time they first came out. And I don't know why that is, it just is. But I think on the Ludlow Garage, what really stands out to me is the Mountain Jam. It's a famous song, of course. It was based on the simple riff from Donovan, First There Is a Mountain song. It's most famous for the version on Eat a Peach, which took up two sides of a vinyl album, which was just incredible at the time. I've taken over many a jukeboxes and bar by just putting on Mountain Jam and really get your money worth that way. Interestingly, something I learned in writing the book is that the guys in the band never really liked the Eat a Peach version. They all felt that it was one of the weaker versions of the song they had played. But Dwayne had died, they needed to finish the album, and it was such a signature song, they wanted to get it out there. It was from the same live concerts that produced the at the Fillmore East album. And so that was a great recording, and they wanted to put it out, so they did. I think if you really listen to them both, that the Ludlow Garage version is better. It's just really great. If you're not a fan of the band, the idea of a 43-minute song, I think, sounds a little bit crazy. It's the kind of thing that people who don't like the Allman Brothers make fun of. So, I, you know, what can I say? If you don't like it, you don't like it. But once you accept that this is a band you love, that's a version of the song you need to hear. I think it's really wonderful. And I think most of the other songs that they were repeated on the Fillmore East recordings a year later sound better, stronger, more cohesive at the Fillmore East than they did in a year earlier in Cincinnati. But the Mountain Jam is an exception. I think it's an exceptional version of the song.
You mentioned Lonnie Mack in reference to Dickie Betts during the book. Do you know if Lonnie Mack interacted with the Allman Brothers Band?
Dickie was a very big fan of Lonnie Mack. You know, Lonnie, of course, is a famously wonderful guitar player. And in Florida, one of the things that Dickie was famous for was being able to play all these Lonnie Mack songs perfectly at a pretty young age. So Lonnie certainly was an important influence on Dickie. I imagine that they have interacted, but I don't know that for sure. I mean, there's certainly interesting stories about Lonnie and the Doors. You know, he played the bass on Roadhouse Blues, and I've talked to Robbie Krieger of the Doors about that quite a bit. He said that Robbie, you know, who's sort of a funny guy, whenever he would see Lonnie, he'd make fun of him and say, "There's my bass player." And Lonnie would get really mad and say, "I'm not a bass player, dang it." So he did play bass on Roadhouse Blues, so...
Warren Haynes and Derek Trucks recently announced they're leaving the Allman Brothers Band this year, and then, even more recent, Greg Allman's announced that this is the last year for the band. Are you going to be covering the band the rest of the year?
I will be going to as many shows as I possibly can. They start playing 14 shows at the Beacon Theater on March 7th through March 29th. I'll be at most of them. I'll be at shows over the summer as they continue. They have not announced fall plans yet, although they definitely will be touring in the fall. I don't know how extensively yet. I hope as much as possible that they will play, and I hope to be there and have a new chapter for the paperback that comes out. The news that they're breaking up is, or not breaking up, but ceasing to tour would be the appropriate terminology, probably has been good for my book. It's generated interest in the band, but I view it as sad news, not happy news. I would rather them continue. I think that what really is driving it is that Derek Trucks and Warren Haynes both just feel that they're being pulled in different directions and want to be able to concentrate on their own projects.
What do you think the legacy is going to be after 45 years?
Well, the musical legacy speaks for itself. I think the music will continue to be played forever. And you know, the stories in my book, I tried to keep focused on the music. Certainly there's drugs, sex, drugs, and drama, and death. And there's no point avoiding that because you can't understand the music, you can't understand the personalities if you don't go into that. But the stories that I talked about are all things that directly impacted the band or their music, because I think that's what's important to keep the focus on. And I think the legacy in the end is the music. It's the music that will continue to be listened to forever. The other stories are interesting in the sense that they help you understand the music, they help you understand the dynamics, they help you understand how and why and when things happened. But the legacy is the music, and that will last. It's lasted 45 years. The stuff they recorded in 1969 sounds as wonderful and fresh, really, as ever, and I don't see any reason that it won't in another 45 years.
Been listening to a special edition of The Blues featuring the music of the Allman Brothers and my conversation with Alan Paul, who's written a biography about the Allman Brothers, One Way Out. You'll find a link to the book, tonight's playlist, and the Allman Brothers Band on WVXU.org. I'm Lee Hay, and this has been The Blues on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.
Thank you.